Welcome to the On Deck Podcast. I'm Sailor Smurf, and in this episode, we're going to be talking to the CEO of Mantis Marine. It is such a great interview. I'm really excited. So let's not delay. Let's get into it. Welcome on board, sailors. I'm coming to you from Marine Mission Control, our studio, which is located at the Yacht Rigger headquarters, situated in sunny St. Pete, Florida. I'm Sailor Smurf, and on deck today, we have Gregory Cutson, MD, the CEO of Mantis Marine. This guy is captivating. He's warm. He's kind. He's brilliant. He's also, as you might have heard in his name, a medical doctor. He's a ER, emergency room doctor, term CEO extraordinaire, has a brilliant mind for engineering and product design, and is just one of those rare individuals that you just, I mean, I hope you guys enjoy listening to his interview here as much as we enjoyed interviewing him. Just a neat, neat dude. So I don't want to delay. I want to be able to get into that right away. The only thing that I want to mention is make you guys aware, if you don't know, about our other media, and that is a video series that we have on YouTube. It's called the On Deck Channel, and you'll find that on YouTube, the On Deck Channel, link in the show notes. So please look that up, check out that content that we have there, and we are excited for any new listeners we have out there. Please leave ratings and comments, help us make this show better. Thank you guys for your time and listening to this interview. I don't want to delay though, because the interview is too good to stop you from hearing awesome individual. So let's go ahead and get right into it.
I heard through the grapevine that you did not start out in yachting and boating products. And so what got you into the idea of making a better anchor?
Yeah, so my profession that I do today is I'm an emergency room physician. And I got hooked on boats when I was working in New Zealand as an emergency room doctor. And I don't know, they probably have two boats per capita. That's an exaggeration, but they're avid boaters over there, and it's a big sport. So I kind of got, you know, as a kid, I always liked boats, but I really got hooked over there. And in fact, after I left New Zealand, I didn't go back to the United States. I jumped on a boat and crewed in a Darwin rally on the catamaran.
And that kind of solidified.
It was a 40 footer.
Nice.
Old guy named Warren had me on there, and along with a film crew that wanted to film indigenous whale hunting. So it was actually quite, and they succeeded, and it was a really interesting experience. Material for another podcast. But so when I got back, I kind of hurried and bought a boat and started prepping it. Got excited about cruising. When I was in New Zealand, I met a lot of old salts in the marina there in Tauranga, and really, really got hooked on it. Started reading books about cruising, and so within 2 years of being back in the United States, I kind of took a sabbatical off work and took off, went sailing. And
how long was the sabbatical, if you don't mind?
It was a year and a half.
Nice.
And I took the boat from, was it Ericsson 38? And we sailed out of, me and the girlfriend at the time, sailed out of Houston and via Mexico, Honduras, and Panama Canal, went to Ecuador, and then kind of came back.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So you go cruising, but this isn't your, is this, when did it, when, what was the impetus for you interacting with an anchor and thinking that you could do it better?
Right. So as I was doing this, I was having issues, and specifically, there's a couple of places I to date remember that were really difficult. My anchor locker looked like a CQR. So it was a 38-foot boat, right? Mm-hmm. And I had a 45-pound CQR, and as a secondary anchor, I had, you know, FX 35 Fortress, I believe. And there's the areas are proved to be difficult. I went to Providencia and San Andres, the two islands that belong to Colombia. I stopped at both, and man, I had such a difficulty hooking up over there. And it was kind of windy, and, you know, it felt like I had a bite. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, I'll be floating away. And it happened again when I moved from Providencia to San Andres, where it took me 3 or 4 times, and I never felt comfortable on the hook. And this is like, well, when it's constantly blowing, trade winds, 30 knots, and it's kind of always in the back of my mind. I didn't feel comfortable leaving the boat for an extended period of time. And when I got to, and I'm not very experienced at this time, especially for kind of living on the hook. So when I finally get to Cartagena, Colombia, there's a bunch of cruisers kind of hanging out, drinking, and everybody's talking in, you know, shop. And you know, we had this idea that we're going to, you know, there's a lot of better anchors out there. This is, you know, at that time, I wasn't really informed as well as I am now. But some good anchors, alternatives, they existed already. Arachna was already out, and Spade was already out. And, you know, we kind of got together, and we thought, we're in Colombia, and there's a lot of good workers there, like easy access to welders. We can kind of make a copy of a Spade. That's kind of what we decided to do. And that was our goal.
So you weren't feeling comfortable on your anchor, and you just decided, hey, let's just copy an anchor and try to improve it. That just fascinates me that you immediately, I just can't imagine. I like to improve.
Not yet. Okay. The initial impetus was, how do we buy a new anchor? It's expensive to ship to Colombia.
Oh.
So it's cheap to get labor quality, you know.
Okay, I'm with you.
Colombia.
I'm with you. Okay.
Let's just hire some guy and copy a Spade.
Totally.
We started doing research and convinced ourselves that Spade is kind of the best thing out there. And we're gonna copy a Spade.
All right. Okay.
And so we priced it, and I think if I remember correctly, it was gonna be something like around $500-$600, something like that, to copy a Spade. And so that's what I was set out to do. And then I thought, well, man, if I'm doing that, I might as well make it out of stainless steel. We're gonna make it really fancy. But then it was kind of a complex design to copy because it had lead in the nose and had a hollow tube. And it wasn't kind of an easy thing to just knock off. We're kind of sitting at a bar. I don't remember how this came up, but somebody was suggesting, you know, this is probably a wrong conclusion that they came to, but I anchored to it, that there's only like 2-3 players in this whole anchor market. You could easily design a better anchor and own the world. And I have no idea why I listened to this narrative and anchored to it. To be honest, maybe there's like a little personal thing going. Like I had was having trouble with in my relationship. Like we were fighting a lot, and it was like a way to get out of it, like get busy with something. So, wow. So I decided I was going to, well, first I'm going to make one out of plywood. And if I could get an anchor of plywood to kind of stick better or have more ability to set than a rock that a buddy of mine had there, then maybe I have something.
And you're doing this, though. I mean, you're a physician, so no background in engineering, right?
Yeah, I mean,
that's just wild. I don't see a lot of doctors spend a lot of free time engineering that. Right, that's pretty unique.
Yeah, I actually want to challenge that a little bit. So I get that a lot, but in the process of becoming a doctor, you kind of get a lot of experience. So you have to have a pretty good knowledge of physics. And now sometimes people forget the material they learned in school. So the basic principles kind of are pretty well grounded in education by the time
okay.
you finish.
So you got
undergrad.
Some overlap
yeah.
there. All right. That's
well,
nice.
I mean, how do you pull a tendon? How do you overextend something? I completely yeah. understand why you're saying that now with the
yeah.
physics. You have to understand how a body moves and why it stays together in the first place before you can figure out why it broke and how to fix it.
Right. So basically I think the basic science teachings and prelude to medical kind of give you a pretty good feel for things like this. But and then of course I like it that my brain is wired that way. So I always tinkered and like I don't know if it's okay to turn it around on a podcast, but you guys probably didn't have a degree in engineering, but you like to work on boats and fix boats, and that's you right. kind of understand how things work, right?
Yeah, so, that's right. Yeah, yeah. You don't have to have a formal background in something to start to gravitate towards that even professionally. So it's right. just what I think is so neat is that a doctor and I hope this doesn't sound bad, but I have some doctors in my life that I'm close with. And I find that a lot of times they work so hard to do that one thing that it's hard for them to develop other skill sets because it's taken so much of their mental capital, of their bandwidth. That is a uniquely intelligent mind.
Well, I appreciate that. But you know what? It might be we make a little advertisement for emergency medicine.
Yeah,
so, please. Yeah, please do. As a physician, most physician professions, you know, you say you're a primary care doctor or you're a surgeon. You have a practice and you have a following. So, you know, you have a number of people that regularly come to you and you have, they depend on you. You know, ER medicine is a little different than that. And that is you work in a clinic and people come to you and you take care of them and you never see them again. So it's easy for somebody like that to take a sabbatical and take a year off or work part-time and have another hobby. So there's a few niches like that. I would say probably emergency medicine, anesthesia, where you can kind of not be 100% doctor.
That makes sense, yeah.
And I'm not sure if subconsciously that's why I picked the profession. There's many reasons why. But yeah, and I also, you know when you like to work in a garage and fix a car and kind of always been kind of a person, you know.
Right, right. But, so that gave you a little bit of time where you could step away, kind of pursue these other things, get to tinker. So you're tinkering with these anchors. You were talking about making one out of plywood,
which is, by the way, what I was waiting patiently to come back to, because if you can even get an anchor to hold made out of plywood, I'm impressed, because for one thing, plywood floats.
yeah
I think so. Anchors, this was
beach pooling and I was fiberglassing plywood together
to watch how it dug in the sand.
Yeah, I thought it would be cheaper way before we went to metal. And then we found a ferreteria, I think they call it, little workshop in Cartagena, Colombia. That was, well, I would go to ATM, pull out cash and say, hey, make this. And
that's a ferreteria is what they call a workshop?
Right.
Or how
right.
do you say that? Okay.
Or maybe ferreteria is a word for
factory.
Like a shop that sells a tool shop, a Home Depot, that thing. Oh. But
someone will have to call in and tell us.
Yeah. but I found a little scrap yard where they were doing welding that was willing to kind of like give me one of those guys and tweak the metal design. I would hire a taxi to go spend a day with me on the beach and pull these anchors with a taxi. You could see that the relationship must have been going
pull it with
bad.
It oh yes. Pull the anchors attached to a taxi.
Yes, drag it behind the taxi on the beach and see if it'll hold.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
your beach pulley. That's awesome,
right? Nice. And then it would go from the beach, we'd go to like grass in somebody's backyard. And
how did that conversation look like though? You're getting a ride in a taxi, and at what point do you ask the cab driver, hey, do you mind if we like come out on the beach and I tie something off to your bumper and drag it through the sand?
Yeah, exactly like that. what are you doing after five?
That's awesome.
Yeah. What would it cost for 5 hours of your time?
Yeah, that's great.
And
so I remember when you were first saying that you were trying to copy, and you said that there were some design challenges on that, brought me to a question that I was waiting patiently to ask. Mm-hmm. Is do you have any lead in your anchor?
No. And it wasn't the fact that, I wasn't set against it. It was...
That's a challenge to get it in there.
Yeah, you can make arguments of why, it's bad for environment or it complicates the production process. But, I just thought that it's not necessary. Like, we get away without it. Not having, having less bulkiness. Like, so you're trying to penetrate a firm sediment. And you have a certain cross section you're trying to drive in it, So yes, lead adds weight, but the shape also matters. So my thought at the time was that we can kind of thin things out and make them sharp and avoid having to have the density of lead in the nose.
Well, just to be quite clear on my bias, I bought a Mantis anchor, and I have never in my life seen an anchor hold so quick and so well that I actually refer to it as my grappling hook.
That's rad. That gives me the chills. That's awesome. Like,
it's amazing. It's nothing short of game changer.
Well, guys, I appreciate you saying that. Every time that you tweak something, you know, nobody ever, I mean, sometimes people invent things, but most of the time you're kind of standing on the shoulders of somebody who's gone before you. So,
of course. Yep.
Like, you know, if you're talking about Pierre Smith, the Rockne designer, Alan Poard, the Spade designer, I mean, those are all those guys move the needle, you know?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, if I knew how good those two anchors are, I might have never like pushed this far.
You would have just bought one and been done with it.
Yeah, but then once you get caught up in the game, you kind of want to convince yourself you did something. So
that's right. Yeah, so, keep pushing it. So was there a eureka moment? You're out there and you're in Cartagena and you're dragging anchors along the beach via a taxi. Was there a breakthrough?
You know, I'll be completely honest in this story because it's not a hero story. It's, yes, there was a time that I was getting these anchors. You know, you have to understand this is very early time in my understanding of what it takes to kind of get a good product. And I was able to get amazing holding power, amazing setting. The goal was like to have this guaranteed set. Sometimes you have a bottom surface that could have like crazy amount of kelp or something that can follow you up, or granite rock that just can't be penetrated till you find a crevice. But outside of these weirdnesses, we want to make sure that the anchor should be able to get you every single time. This like an emergency brake on the car. It needs to stop the boat first time every time. And if it happens to somehow pop out, it needs to reset. That's kind of the design prerogative, right? Mm-hmm. But at some point in time, easy way to kind of get there is to shallow out the angle between the shank and the fluke.
Increase the scope.
Right. Well, they're right. So the angle between the shank and the fluke, if it's shallow, it makes the setting a little bit easier, but then it's at the expense of a holding power. So I got to a point where we were setting amazingly well, much better than the Rockne and the Spade, comparable size. But we were not having the same holding power and softer side of the bottoms. And for that, by the way, it was kind of a cool story. I was using, there's a guy, I wish I remembered his name. He was older gentleman. He was a little bored and he was willing to help me out. He lent me his boat and would pull anchors outside Club Nautica Marina in this softer sediment. And we would have Rockne, a Spade, and a Bugel. Bugel is kind of first. Rockne gets his credit for having the roll bar design, but actually the first time that was used was a Bugel, a German company.
Interesting.
Bugel and Kay. And
are they still around by any chance?
They are. You don't see them very often here.
Yeah.
Buggel, I think it's spelled. And then basically, like I said, we always, humans, we always iterate when we innovate, and we, so that was the first roll bar design. And then when Peter Smith looked at that, he realized he can improve the fluke on that design. Is a flat plate. It's a flat plate in triangular shape and a roll bar.
And what's the fluke?
Right. So the anchor, had kind of the first Mantis anchor has really three parts. It has a shank, which is the part that you pull on, has a fluke, which is a plate that offers a resistance to pull in the ground.
That's what buries in the sand or in
correct
substrate. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Kind of think of it as shovel. Mm-hmm. And the blade, some people call it, right? That's a fluke.
Oh, right. Oh, okay.
And then the roll bar, is what with kind of the innovation of the Bugel, which, if anchor rolls upside down, it rides the anchor over. And
right. Okay.
So Bugel kind of came up with that, but the Rockne designer kind of realized that the shank and the fluke could be optimized and have been on other designs. Kind of combined it all together to make yet another better variation, you know. And then the other thing that we wanted to do is we wanted to make the anchor, it had to be collapsible, because one of the things that we wanted to do is it had to, you had to be able to stow it flat. And the reason for this is, one, you damage anchors all the time by bending the shank. You get stuck, you damage the anchor. And we thought it was silly to have to replace the whole thing if you damage a part of the anchor. So we wanted to make it out of pieces so you could easily swap out those pieces. And I didn't at the time have a business plan or a business vision of how I wanted to sell them more than ideally, if I had one, I would want to be able to easily swap out a piece, you know, versus kind of replacing the whole thing.
Absolutely. So, or store it flat.
Right, right. I mean, and then once we grew as a company, it became, you know, one of the nice advantages was what you could start flat for stocking and shipping. And then big anchors, it makes a big deal. And then we also have a lifetime warranty. So if somebody is in Tahiti and they damage their anchor, we can ship them a replacement, and it's doable, you know.
Go ahead.
No.
Well, I was just wondering, at what point then did you know that you had this viable business? You talked about just some of those iterations that you made. You kind of knew what you needed to change and where you wanted to focus down on, that it's modular, if that's a okay term to use, and packs down and a little bit better for transporting, good warranties, things like that. But when was that crossover, that inflection point that you could actually quit your day job?
Oh, much later. So I leave Colombia. It's time to go. And I take this anchor prototype and I start using it as my main anchor. But before I do so, I send an email to, I forgot the name of the gentleman now, but he was an anchor tester at West Marine. West Marine had this guy who was an authority on anchors, and he was in charge of what anchors West Marine would sell on the shelf. And I found his name from the article when West Marine did tests on the Manson Supreme and the Rockna. And I sent this email. I made the very rudimentary video showing how maybe we're a little bit better. And I got a reply from him saying, you know, hard to believe, but send me something. And I didn't have time because it was time to go. I spent way too much time in Cartagena, Colombia, and I needed to get back to the United States. Well, after I got back to the United States and started working in the ER, I kind of had the funds to support continuing playing with it. And I continued kind of to fine tune the design into what I thought was going to be marketable. So I had this idea that I wanted to sell them if it was good enough. But in the process of doing it, I ran into a guy named Scott Kala, one of the guys that lives in the marina, and he said, well, you know, he just came back from China and he had all these connections in China, and he told me how easy it is to, you know, if you have an idea, if you want to turn it into reality, you just make a trip over there and, you know, he give me the name of the guy. And so at this point in time, I kind of had a working prototype, and I reached out to this guy that Scott gave me and got a quote for 45 pound anchor. And so then I went around and tried to get something similar in the United States, and it was like 3-4 times the price, you know. So I decided, okay, I'll go to China and I meet this guy. So I made that trip,
you must have been pretty sure making a trip like that. I mean, you really felt like you had a pretty good shot at this, a good product, huh?
To be honest, I'm a spontaneous guy, and it was at that time I had no commitments, and I thought I would just go and check out what Jay, the name of the guy that I was going to meet, he was actually an employee for an American company in China. He found a friend of a friend who didn't have much going on. It was a welder. And they kind of priced it, and they thought that I could do it for this much. It was all basically a bunch of bubbas trying to pull this together. and it wasn't like I got hooked up with a factory or anything like that. It was just a friend of a coworker. And to date, that's the same person that I'm working with. So actually,
no kidding. Being, really? Wow. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. All he right. was a, Ching was a sculptor. He was a stainless steel sculptor. And as always, artists don't do well financially. So, but he had, he has hands of gold and he's good at what he does. And, it kind of grew together, you know? So, but, you know, he basically, Jay, said, you know, if you want, where are we talking? Are you serious or what is this all about? Because if you're serious, I need some money. So I sent over $40,000 to a man I met once.
Wow.
For an order of galvanized anchors. And ever since then, it was kind of a learning and improving process. It was definitely not piece of cake.
It was not an immediate success right out the gate, huh?
No.
It was easy. Everybody would do it, right?
Yeah. The first time we got the shipment, the first very shipment we got, first of all, it came some 9 months later. You know, it was promised a 2-month delivery, but it came 9 months later. And I couldn't reach anybody. So I transferred this amount of money and 6 months later, nothing. Nobody's answering my emails. Somebody ended up in the hospital, really sick, couldn't get back to me. Ended up, there's no, no fault business, but certainly suspecting it, you know.
Sure.
And then we got the shipment and the roll bars were wrong diameter. So I had to manually make them here in the United States after work. So it was definitely a learning experience. But slowly but surely, we kind of grew.
So you got that together, got your first shipments out. What was some of your first customer feedback that you heard? Was that what pushed you forward or what got you in
gear? You know, we never sent out anything that I didn't think that I could be kind of proud of. So whatever issues we had with manufacturing, whatever the cost, we kind of had to solve before we get out to the customer. So the reviews were good because, and you know, short of a manufacturing flaw, it had to be good because we spent a lot of time kind of making sure that the product would be good. You know, our biggest issue initially was shank strength. We were using kind of steel that wasn't the strongest material available. We didn't have ability to weld high strength steel in the first few batches, just because you had to know what you're doing with
sure.
that. And so that was our first big challenge. But overall, the challenge was the fact that I was still an emergency room doctor. So it was kind of a lot of times people get in the business and if they're not all in, the business doesn't go very far, you know? So it's kind of hard to be all in when you don't have any help and you're the, you know, you have a profession on top of what you currently do.
How many hours a week were you in the ER?
Yeah. So, normally doctor worked kind of full time, kind of like you work a full time. Really? So kind of to put a new startup on top of that with a bunch of issues, we actually had to physically fix them. That was kind of, and I had help. At the time I was dating, a girl, named Deneen, and she, was, very helpful, she's an engineer. She was a NASA aerospace engineer. And she was, kind of went all in trying to help, so, and her help was both both from an engineering science standpoint, but even more so, just emotional support, just because when you're doing something like this, it's very easy to kind of give up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially after, instead of going drinking with friends, you're bending roll bars.
yeah, that's unique. For sure.
What about year was that? How long ago was that?
That was 10 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what did you have a big order come through or something that you just slowly, steadily grew to the point that you thought?
Slowly.
And
the business. Good. No. So the business was losing money for first 6 years, I would say. It was losing money, but I was also pushed very aggressively because I knew I wanted to prove it to myself and I'm horrible, but to my mother, this was not idiotic. Idiotic, I'm from a Russian family, so where mother is like this lioness that is in charge of everything, and which is diverting from medicine, which she fought hard.
There's somewhere you've been clear this whole time. Maybe you've moved somewhere a little bit. You're starting to break up.
Yeah. How about now?
Okay. Yeah.
Much better.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Okay. So your mom.
So I was trying to prove to myself and everyone around me that I'm not a complete idiot. So I was pushing really hard for us to be successful, and I wanted to kind of create other products, kind of keep going with this, right? This is not going to be I'm not going to make it a successful company if we're going to sell anchors. I didn't think that was going to be the solution.
What other products do you have in your lineup?
Over the 10 years, we kind of developed other ground tackle accessories, so chain hooks and swivels and bow rollers. Things kind of will come along and make sense to produce with anchors. But then we branched out into some miniature scuba gear and a scuba diving compressor. And our latest ambition is to make a better dinghy for the cruising community.
Really? I would love to know more about that if that's something you can talk about.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll push it off to the next episode.
For sure. Sounds good.
Just we're trying to, it's just bad superstition.
I understand. I was surprised to hear you bring it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. What was the first thing that you made outside of anchors and all your ground tackle?
Yeah. So the next thing we tried to do is chain hook. And we had a pretty cool idea of the chain hook. We no longer sell it, but it was an interesting design. And again, that's another time that I tried to make something in the United States. And maybe I just didn't push hard enough, but it is hard to make a price competitive product in the United States.
I can speak to that. My dad's in manufacturing and it's incredibly difficult. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have to go to China more and more. And unless it's aerospace or it is medical, where they have to have a certain chain of regulation, and accessibility, then intolerances and things like that, it's almost all just out of China. And China's been,
right.
I mean, they can produce some excellent stuff. You know, DJI,
right.
The drone company, among other things, now camera company, is, that guy, I can't think of the CEO's name and the founder, but he said that he wanted to up people's perception of what is manufactured in China by over-manufacturing and creating a high, high quality product that's made there. And I have a lot of DJI stuff and there's really nothing like it. I mean, even just the silly little case that your headphones come in is better than anybody else's case. I mean, it takes a premium device like Apple to rival a lot of the stuff that they make that might just be ancillary to the main product that they're even putting out. It's pretty
sure,
awesome.
Sure, sure, sure. Some amazing Chinese brands that came out in the recent years. Yeah,
it's really great. So you're getting your stuff made out there, and it can be hard to be in the U.S. for sure.
Right. So we tried, and but unfortunately, it was just one failure after another. And we tried to make it locally here in Houston, and we actually found a foundry that we paid for tooling, and the tooling ended up being defective, and we lost a bunch of money. So. So it was definitely a very painful kind of first few years where we kind of were sinking money and trying to make stuff in the United States, and then finally we're able to source it again in China and kind of make a go of it. So chain hook is our second product, and then make scuba diving more accessible. So we wanted to make a miniature, on a boat, storage is a premium, and you're kind of always trying to figure out what you're going to take, what you're not going to take, and how to best miniature stuff, right? So we thought that diving with big tanks is something for resorts, but if you're gonna dive on a boat, you're either gonna use a FOCA system or you can have a smaller tank, and if you have a smaller tank, then everything else gets smaller. You don't need BCD with a smaller tank. You have less weights with a smaller tank. And then you can have a small miniature compressor to kind of fill up your tanks and kind of keep going and going at it.
What's your bottom time on your smaller tank?
Yeah, so it's about 30 feet, 30 minutes at 30 feet. It's a, you know, it's definitely very different from, you know, you diving on a scuba diving excursion. But we're kind of picturing, like, what does a cruiser do? Well, you're usually anchored in 20, 30 feet, and you're going to explore kind of in the same area. And maybe you're going to spearfish, and maybe you're going to work on your boat. And, you know, and I was kind of reflecting how I used the gear I took. I took a hookah system, a kind of homemade hookah system, and I took a Husky Home Depot compressor, put a 5-micron filter on it, and hooked it up to generator. It was very, very DIY.
That's awesome.
But I kind of pictured that if people are using it the way I'm using it, then they don't need, a big tank.
And no,
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, lightweight, something that's just easier to throw on and doesn't take up a bunch of room and get out there and do some exploring. You know, you're not trying to build a oil derrick or anything like that underwater. It's not tech diving. So, yeah, that definitely makes sense. I'm looking forward to getting more into the scuba world myself once we get the boat. And so, yeah, I can't wait to get into your products and take a deep dive on them.
Yeah. We would love to be able to accommodate.
Absolutely. So where are you at today? What's the business look like? You mentioned, maybe doing some dinghy development and things like that, but what's the big focus today?
Well, we want to continue improving. I think that's what kind of sets us apart, is that I want this to be something that sets us apart. I don't know how successful we are, is that we don't want to ever be comfortable where you have a SKU and it's horribly successful and you just like leave it alone. I think that's when somebody else comes in and does it better. So we want to be able to keep the number of SKUs limited enough to where you have enough time to pay attention to them and continue to improve them. So that's kind of what I want to do. And always looking for the new idea that, one, has to promise income. But two, it has to be something that I get excited about, that I can do better than currently done. I can talk about the boat a little bit. I mean, in principle, right? Mm-hmm. So we have rigid inflatables, and that kind of world kind of accepted rigid inflatables as the dinghy of choice. And part of the reason I think is because it's so easy to use them, as in you don't have to worry about bumping stuff. You can come to dock and you can bump, and you could come to the boat and you could bump. And they're light, but they have a huge downside to them, and that the tubes can easily be damaged, and they can be damaged by abrasion or cutting with collision with a nail or something like that, or a knife, or just over time, it just becomes they're kind of high maintenance because they're constantly leaking. You constantly have to fill them up, top them off. So I think that there is a certain element of danger, that if you can lose a tube, you could be in trouble. And two, I think they're kind of hard to maintain. They don't hold their value. So if you can imagine that you had a boat that didn't have those deficits, they had all the advantages of a rigid inflatable. In fact, it was light and easy to maneuver and not worry about damaging your mothership. But was more durable, why not, right?
For sure. So, yeah. If it could be lighter and more durable, that sounds great to me.
Yeah. So, not lighter, but as light.
Or as light.
Because I think,
and more durable. So, yeah.
Right. So basically, in essence, what we're doing is we're making a polyethylene dinghy. Well, the challenge was that there's other polyethylene small boats on the market. Mm-hmm. They don't quite fit the bill because they're heavy. and not designed really for the cruiser.
I see.
But we're aiming is to kind of, take it, A, B in high field and be one-on-one with them on performance and ease of use. But kind
affordability.
Of affordability. Right. I think, I wanted to be aggressive there, but to be honest, I think we'll be in the same ballpark. Because once you accessorize this boat, we're going to put a bumper on it and stainless steel hand holders.
Well, quite frankly, being in the same neighborhood of the price range is acceptable if you're improving the design.
Right. If you're gaining durability and you're not adding weight
right.
and I gain something and it costs the same amount. So why would I not use that?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing is long-term value and ease of maintenance. Yes. Yeah. You don't have to worry about constantly maintaining the tubes, and that my hope is that 4 or 5 years down the road you could sell it for 70% of its value because mm-hmm. it's still a functional boat that doesn't have any degradation.
So you want to make the Honda or Toyota of the dinghy world.
Yes,
reliable.
Yes.
Good resale.
Right.
Set your watch by it.
Yeah.
That's
yes.
sweet. I like it. Here's a question for you. Why Mantis? Like the name, where'd that come from?
Yeah, randomness. So at some point in time, I think the choices were like Titan and something. I was actually really impressed with everybody else. I was Spade. I thought it was an awesome name, because it kind of looks like a spade and it's easy and looks good and the Rachna sounds like a rock. I thought I was really impressed by all those. At some point in time, the Mantis looked like the giant manta or the the insect. So I think it might have been suggested at some point in time, but then kind of there was a problem with the name, and that is there's another anchor company called the Manson Supreme, and it was very close, and I didn't realize it was going to cause a problem, but it definitely did, because so many times we get an email and they're saying, you have a defective, horrible galvanization. I want a replacement. And we would say, of course, what's the address? And then, somebody said, well, let's take a look. Can you send us a picture? And it would be, a competitor.
Yep, different. not our product.
Yeah, yeah.
And interesting.
Huge sigh of relief. But yeah, so, and not to say that Manson Supreme has bad galvanization. I was just giving
sure, you an example. Yeah. Yeah. And that you have similar names. So you just thought it sounded cool mostly.
Yeah. Yeah. It had a good ring to it. And, I honestly don't remember, how it was picked. I remember it being in the running of all the names written down on a piece of paper. What I didn't want to do, I didn't want my last name to be associated with it. So, you have very, if you think of aerospace industry, you got Lockheed and Boeing and this kind of the thing, right? My last name is horrible sounding. So it just, there's no way it was going to make it into the brand.
Yeah. It just seems like a less creative approach to just throw your last name in there. I know it can satisfy the ego for sure, having your name on a building, but I always applaud people who take a creative approach to it rather than the other one. That's definitely interesting.
There's something to be said for anonymity.
Yeah. Right.
No kidding. Yeah.
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 What are, when people are setting an anchor, do you have any special anchor setting tips for the cruiser out there, particularly if they're using your product?
Yeah. I mean, nothing unique to us. I think that in general, scope. Just having enough scope. I think that, sometimes you're limited in how much line you could put out just because it's a busy anchorage. There is a mooring field, boats are really tight. But if you can, I think it's all about scope. And sometimes even you could set anchor with a lengthy scope and then shorten up on it. But you're not ideal situation. We want you to stay at short, at long scope. But
like my ASA class taught me 7:1 on the amount of scope that would be out. Would you think more than that? Are you ever doing the math in that way? I mean, see, I don't know the functional side.
So we can reference kind of the website knowledge base for the exact numbers, but basically, you know, in 7-to-1 is fine in nominal conditions, and I say nominal conditions like winds 20 knots, let's say less than 25 knots. But if you, it's anything over that is kind of getting into more serious territory. I would try to take advantage of all the holding power the anchor can offer, and I would try to go 10-to-1. So
excellent.
At 10-to-1, I have to reference against the table again, but I think that at 10-to-1, you're at like 85% of the maximum holding power of an anchor. And maximum holding power of an anchor is if you're pulling parallel to the ground, like infinite scope, right? So anytime you shorten the scope and pulling it at a bigger angle, some of the vectors are pointing straight up and pulling anchor out versus...
I'd like to jump in there real quick and say you a little bit of anecdotal story on my own boat. So mm-hmm. I agree with what he's saying here, that scope is king, and it can really make up for a not very good anchor to have much more scope. That being said, I chose that my boat, when I would be coming in and out of a very crowded anchorage or a very crowded ramp area or something like that, I would always make sure that I had my Mantis anchor on a quick release line. And as I'm coming into a hairy situation, I would already have about 3-to-1 scope cleated off. So if I got into a situation where I'm turning a corner, it's a blind corner, and I couldn't see what was going on the other side, and I come around the corner and I'm in a place where I have to abort what I was thinking I was going to do, I would throw the boat in reverse and drop the anchor immediately. And it has saved me two times now. That's not many, but it's still
a lot when it's your boat.
That's exactly right.
High stakes.
So when I come around the corner and I go, oh geez, and I pull that line and throw it in reverse and it backs up and parks it instantly with 3-to-1 scope, that's where you go, okay, that was amazing.
It's pretty great.
That was amazing.
Yeah, there's a good pro tip. So
I don't want to tell people that they should go out with 3-to-1 scope, but I can tell you that that's what I did in shallow water situations when I was worried about maneuverability or being able to abort a mission. I would always have that there, and so far to date, I've not had it not hold.
I think you have bring up a really good point because you know, there's kind of more than one aims at anchoring. So, you know, you could anchor a boat and really high winds, and the idea is, you know, versus what you have described, which is you want to kind of use it as an emergency brake, right?
Yep.
And I have a couple of stories that kind of motivated me to, and I can kind of bring, you know, this kind of lends us into a product that we designed. But the idea that if your engine dies and you're in the canal surrounded by rocks, and there's winds on your beam at 25 knots, and you have a few seconds to react. I think that ability to be able to, not just what anchor you have, but just that ability to deploy something fast, not having to go to the bow and, mm-hmm. you know, undo your ties, and you just don't have time sometimes, mm-hmm. Especially if you're single-handed. So what we did is we kind of, it's called the stern bracket, and it allows you to stern the anchor, you know, in your cockpit, kind of where you are. Usually I'm kind of picturing like my boat, which was an aft cockpit, a sailboat. And right next to the wheel, there's an anchor rigged to some line, kind of exactly what you just described.
Wow, that completely makes sense. I've seen that on your site. Yes. And I didn't understand the importance of that, but wow, that makes sense.
Yes. And mm-hmm. where I sail in and out of everywhere, every time I go sailing was Clearwater. And Clearwater has exactly what he's describing, which is a rock jetty on one wall all the way across with predominantly north-south winds with an east-west channel that's only about, 130 feet wide at the smallest part. And so you kind of think, what would I do right now if this didn't work? And so having one at your fingertips ready to chuck in and knowing and having confidence that it will grab when it goes in is pretty paramount to feeling relaxed and comfortable in those situations.
Yeah, absolutely. There's several YouTube videos I've seen of cats being just thrown up against the rocks and just getting crushed by enveloped, just being enveloped by waves. and it's just beating it. And, you know, I go to dig into the story of what happened there, and so many times, and now I kind of anticipate it. They had engine failure, suffered some kind of issue there. They weren't far off from shore. You have all the cragging from all the rocks there, and they just got thrust into it. And I, you know, you think of dropping an anchor in that, but I also know there's quite a bit of moving parts to making that happen, especially if it's everything's abrupt and under these conditions you're describing. That is a brilliant piece of mind. That's a great idea you had there, Greg.
I agree completely. I also wanted to ask you, when and how were you able to omit the roll bar, because the M2 anchor came out and holds, I haven't tested them all, but it sure seems like it holds as well as the M1, or very, very close to it, and setting ability.
Yeah, so without getting into like the geekiness of it all, you know, kind of you like talked about superficially, I don't think, you know, I kind of alluded earlier that the spade design, the Rockna Vulcan, I'm not sure that the roll bar design, the roll bar design in itself is somehow crazy superior. No, you can have an anchor just as good without the rope, and each one has an advantage and a disadvantage. And I would say that I wouldn't think twice about going cruising on either. Okay. In fact, I wouldn't think twice about going cruising on a competitor design. I think a spade is an excellent choice, and I think the Rockna Vulcan is an excellent choice. There's certain things that make us feel special, but those are nuances that I think, you know, the ability that it stores and maybe it has slightly better performance in certain button type kind of thing, and we kind of market that up. But in general, a kind of all new gen anchors give you much better performance than their predecessors, and they kind of do their job, you know. Now, having said that, within so a roll bar anchor has an advantage. It's really good at rolling over, meaning the anchors that don't have a roll bar are not as good as rolling over. So, for example, if you're in really soft muck and you have a Delta or Mantis M2 or a Vulcan, you're a lot more likely to get stuck in that upside down position. It's very unlikely because the anchor is weighed, so it falls correctly. But if somehow it pulls out and gets stuck upside down and that shank sinks, you know, you're more, a lot more likely to roll over if you have a roll bar than if you have, if you're relying on the shank to roll over, the shape of a shank, you know?
Interesting.
So, that's an advantage of a roll bar anchor. You know, resetting, right? And resetting in challenging conditions. On the flip side, especially with smaller anchors, you can have something lodged in the roll bar and fall an anchor. Now, it's unlikely, and the bigger you get, the less likely it gets, but a roll bar could be a hindrance, right? The other issue is that if you have a roll bar and you're in really dense sediment, the roll bar could be a hindrance for you going deeper, from anchor diving deeper.
Makes sense.
And the softer bottom, a roll bar actually helps and offer, gives you a little more resistance. So it's not like a black and white story.
So as with anything else, boating is a compromise.
Man, I was going to say that. Everything's a trade-off in boating.
Everything in boating
no
is a compromise.
No matter what the budget is, no matter anything, it's a trade-off.
Yeah. We had to come up with a design without a roll bar just because we're missing about 30% of the market where the boat design at the bow is such that...
wouldn't fit.
It doesn't fit. Yeah.
Yep.
And having designed the M2... which one would I pick to go cruising? I don't know.
If I was going to go cruising for long term, I'd have an M1 and an M2 next to each other.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Two rollers, right?
I mean, in all honesty, from what you just said, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think that the situations in which the design of one would supersede the other are so rare. I think I would be easily comfortable with both, but both are designed with the idea in mind that we want you to have this complete, you know, you throw it, it works, and you don't have to think twice about it. And unless it's something so extreme, 6 foot tall kelp, they usually don't have to worry about the setting of the anchor.
Now, I also want to mention, and I sure that you can tell that I'm a believer of your products. But I wanted to mention also your very cool little dinghy anchor, that little kit that you put in for the dinghy. Because what I have actually used that for is, there's an old term in sailing called kedging. And kedging is where you want to pull on the ground tackle to get you somewhere. So basically that anchor is so small and light that you can literally twirl it by the anchor line and chuck it and throw it very far, get it to hook, pull your dinghy up through the shallows, and then pull it out and do it again.
It's like
and
Batman's grappling hook.
That's why horizontal. We started calling it the grappling hook.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned that earlier.
Exactly why we were calling it that.
So it all comes full circle.
Yes.
Yeah. Nice. Well, what makes that anchor good is we took that, you know, at 2 pounds, in the weight of the dinghy anchor, we don't have a new generation anchor. Like nobody makes it. So that, you know, what makes M1 so special is that, you know, more than 45% of the weight of the anchor is actually on the tip. And, you know, others have claimed something similar, but that's, that is the only one, even compared to the M2, that has so much of a weight distributed on the tip. Percent of the total weight of the anchor distributed on the tip. And because of that, it still hooks up good at 2 pounds. So at 2 pounds, it's really hard to have an anchor that light. You know, weight is a big deal.
Yes.
And so at 2 pounds, it's really, you don't have a lot of weight to really bite. But because most of it is at the tip, or over a pound of it is at the tip, and it's really thin nose, you could get a good bite, you know, a reliable bite on the dinghy anchor.
Well, that was a home run, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other products there? What's your favorite thing that you've ever designed? Is it just the anchor, or is there a surprise answer in there?
There's a surprise anchor. There's a surprise answer that I can't share with you just yet.
More to come. All right, we're gonna have to have you back on then. Next episode.
And I'll tell you what it is. I just can't tell you, can't show you a picture or describe what it is. Basically, it's yet another chain hook, it's a very small, and you know, I don't know how important you think that is of a product, but sounds pretty insignificant, but. And I don't know why this idea eluded me for so long, but basically we have yet another version 3 chain hook coming out. But I can't tell you exactly.
You must've had a really eureka moment. You just blew our minds. Cause right? We totally thought dinghy.
Yeah. I thought you were going somewhere else with that. Yep, completely, yep. So.
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, a dinghy, you know, it's funny because I kind of made a decision that we're not going to add SKUs of small stuff. Like, we're not going to make yet, you know, remember what I said, my vision was, is that we need to be able to pay attention to all the SKUs that we have and continually improve them. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't want to, add small things.
Well, it makes sense. Like a quality over quantity type of situation. You
yes.
Know? I think
yes.
of going to In-N-Out Burger and look at how focused their menu is. It's like 4 things on there or whatever. I mean, I like when a company doubles down on the products that they have are focused, they're upgraded, they're evolving, and they're doing it with excellence.
Right. Well, that's kind of the idea that we, and also not only for maintaining the focus on improvement, but also just to kind of as a business sense, if you have, you know, we're not in an industry where we sell tens of thousands. We're in an industry where we sell thousands if we're lucky.
Right.
And so if you're going to add another SKU, which costs $50, $70, if you're going to grow the company, that's not what's going to give you. You're going to have a bunch of products that you sell in low volume and you have to maintain, right? So
yep. I have to fanboy on you here for a second. I listened to all these podcasts when I first got into sailing, and I always heard Mantis as a sponsor to different podcasts. I'd listen to a lot less podcasts now because I work on boats full time, and so I don't quite have the time I used to. But so I don't know that you're still doing that or not. But somehow, and this is a testament to your marketing that you were doing around 2018 and 19, your brand worked itself into my head as a total novice, knowing no one who sells, being completely outside the world. I'm just informed by YouTube and podcasts at the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, man, Mantis Anchors, like that's where it's at. I know I want a Mantis. I don't know much about boats, but dang it, I want a Mantis Anchor. And so when I heard that you were going to be at the Annapolis Boat Show in 2018, I was totally looking out for your booth. I got to meet you. It was great. Got to see your product range. It was just a moment for me. And then it's a moment all over again to now have you on a podcast, you know?
Right. I mean, comes full circle.
Though. How cool is that? You know? Right. So yeah, I was really looking forward to today's episode for sure. And just thank you so much for giving your time the way that you have and answering questions. And I really look forward to having you on in the future.
Oh, I really appreciate it. I really enjoyed being on, and thank you for what you just said.
Well, that's all we got in this episode of the On Deck Podcast. I do hope that you'll leave a comment and you will give us a rating. Any engagement like that really helps our channel get out there. We are here to serve the cruising community and aspiring cruisers who are out there, to educate, to equip, to inform, to inspire. That's our ethos. That's what we're here to do. Please don't forget, also check out our channel on YouTube, the On Deck channel. And thank you guys for listening to episode 1. Sailor Smurf out.